Blog Talk Radio.
Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show, coming to you from our studios in El Paso, Texas, gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, this is June 6th, 75 years ago. It was known as D-Day. It was a Tuesday. And the Allies invaded Normandy. It was called Operation Overlord. Now, within Operation Overlord were Operation Neptune, which was D-Day itself, the largest seaborne invasion in history. The overall landing in Europe was Overlord. The D-Day... I guess you could say a subcategory of Overlord was Neptune. And the beginning of the operation was the liberation of German-occupied France. And from there, it was believed that the Allies would branch out and recover Western Europe from Nazi control. And it laid the foundation for the Allied victory on the Western Front. Now, planning for this operation actually began in 1943. In the months leading up to the invasion, the Allies conducted a major military deception codenamed Operation Bodyguard. Now, the intent was to mislead the Germans as to the date and location of the main Allied landings. Now, at this point in time, Patton was in the doghouse and had been removed from his command and put over the shadow units, I guess you could call it. And the Germans couldn't believe that what they called the best general the Allies had was not actively involved in what was going to happen. So they were watching where Patton was. Now, the weather on D-Day was not ideal. In fact, the operation had to be delayed 24 hours. It was supposed to be June 5th. And if they postponed any more, they'd have to delay for 2 weeks, as the invasion planners had requirements for the phase of the moon, the tides, the time of day that and only a few days each month were deemed suitable. Hitler put Rommel in command of German forces and of developing the fortifications along the Atlantic Wall in anticipation of an Allied invasion. Had Rommel not run afoul of politics, he might well have defeated the Allied invasion. Now, the amphibious landings were preceded by extensive aerial and naval bombardment and an airborne assault. In fact, shortly after midnight, 24,000 U.S., British, and Canadian airborne troops landed. Allied infantry and armored divisions began landing on the coast of France at 6:30 in the morning. The target 50-mile stretch of the Normandy coast was divided into five sectors: Utah, Omaha, Gold, Juneau, and Sword. Strong winds blew the landing craft east of their intended positions, particularly Utah and Omaha. And the men landed under heavy fire from gun emplacements overlooking the beaches. And the shore was mined and covered with obstacles such as wooden stakes, metal tripods, barbed wire. That made the work of clearing the beaches difficult at best. Casualties were heaviest at Omaha with its high cliffs. At Gold, Juneau, and Sword, there were some fortified towns that were cleared in house-to-house fighting. And two major gun emplacements at Gold were disabled using specialized tanks. Well, the best laid plans of mice and men. You can have the most brilliant plan in the world, but it's all going to go south about 10 minutes after you make contact with the enemy. So on the first day of the operation, the Allies did not achieve any of their objectives. Carrington, St. Lo, and Bayeux remained in German hands, and Caen, a major objective, wasn't captured until July 21st. Only two of the beaches, Juneau and Gold, were linked on the first day, and all five beachheads weren't connected till June 12th. However, the operation gained a foothold that gradually expanded over the coming months. German casualties on D-Day were estimated to be between 4,000 and 9,000 men. Allied casualties were at least 10,000. 4,414 are confirmed dead. Now, one of the impetus for D-Day was Joseph Stalin. After the Germans invaded the Soviet Union in June of 1941, Stalin began pushing the Allies for the creation of a second front in Western Europe to take the pressure off of Russia. You know, one of the reasons Germany lost the First World War was having to fight a two-front war. So Stalin was hoping he could get that geared up. In late May of 1942, the Soviet Union and the U.S. made a joint announcement that a full understanding was reached in regard to the urgent task of creating a second front in Europe in 1942. But Churchill persuaded U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt to postpone the invasion as there just wasn't enough Allied forces to do it. Now, instead of an immediate return to France, the Western Allies staged defensive in the Mediterranean theater of operations, where there were British troops already stationed. By mid-1943, the campaign in North Africa had been won. Allies just launched an invasion of Sicily in July of 43 and invaded the Italian mainland in September that same year. By then, the Soviet forces were on the offensive and had won a major victory at the Battle of Stalingrad. The decision to undertake a cross-channel invasion within the next year was taken at the Trident Conference in Washington in May of 43. Initial planning was constrained by the number of available landing craft, most of which are already committed to the Mediterranean and the Pacific. At the Tehran Conference in November of 43, Roosevelt and Churchill promised Stalin they would finally reopen or open the long-delayed Second Front by May of 1944. Now, there were four sites actually considered for the landings. Brittany, the Cotentin Peninsula, Normandy, and the Pas de Calais. Now, as Brittany and Cotentin are peninsulas, it would have been possible for the Germans to cut off the Allied advance at a relatively narrow isthmus, so these sites were rejected. With the Pas de Calais being the closest point in continental Europe to Britain, the Germans considered it the most likely area for the invasion. So it was the most heavily fortified. But, assuming they could get ashore, it offered few opportunities for expansion. Too many rivers and canals. Whereas landings on a broad front in Normandy would prevent simultaneous threats against the ports of Cherbourg, coastal ports further west in Britain, and an overland attack toward Paris, and eventually into the heart of Germany. So they chose Normandy. The most serious drawback of the Normandy coast was the lack of port facilities, but that'd be overcome through the development of artificial mulberry harbors, as they were called. Series of modified tanks, nicknamed Hobart's Funnies, dealt with specific requirements expected for the Normandy campaign, such as mine clearing, demolishing bunkers, and mobile bridging. Now, it's interesting to look at the troops that made up the Normandy campaign. There were the Brits, us, New Zealand, Canada, Australia, Czechoslovakia, France, Norway, and Poland. The commanders, our overall commander was Eisenhower. Under him was Montgomery, Omer Bradley, Miles Dempsey, British, Trafford Lee Mallory, British, Bertram Ramsey, British, and Arthur Teeter, British. On the German side, Gerd von Rundstedt, Rommel, Leo Geyer von Sweppenberg, Frederick Dahlmann, Hans von Salmuth, and Wilhelm Fehle had Rommel's plans had been used, it'd have been a coin toss. Now, under the overall umbrella of Operation Bodyguard, the Allies conducted several subsidiary operations designed to mislead the Germans as to the date and location of the landings. Operation Fortitude included Fortitude North, a misinformation campaign using fake radio traffic to lead the Germans into expecting an attack on Norway. And Fortitude South, a major deception involving the creation of a fictitious 1st U.S. Army Group under Lieutenant General Patton, supposedly located in Kent and Sussex. Fortitude South was intended to deceive the Germans into believing the main attack would take place at Calais. Patton was stationed in England until July 6th, continuing to deceive the Germans into believing a second attack would take place at Calais. Many of the German radar stations on the French coast were destroyed in preparation for the landings. And on the night before the invasion, a small group of Special Air Service operators deployed dummy paratroopers over Le Havre and Isigny. These dummies led the Germans to believe that an additional airborne landing had occurred. On that same night, Operation Taxable, number 617 squadron of the RAF dropped strips of window metal foil that caused a radar return. It was mistakenly interpreted by German radar operators as a naval convoy near Le Havre. And that illusion was bolstered by a group of small vessels towing barrage balloons. All in all, we tried every trick we could think of to keep the Germans from massing their forces at Normandy. Had it not been for that, it could have been a bloodbath. Now, upset by the raids on Dieppe and St. Nazaire in 42, Hitler ordered the construction of fortifications all along the Atlantic coast from Spain to Norway. The idea was to protect against a suspected Allied invasion. He wanted 15,000 emplacements manned by 300,000 troops. But shortages, particularly of concrete and manpower, meant that most of the strong points were never built. Had they been built as he ordered, the Normandy invasion probably would have failed. As it was expected to be decided, the invasion, the Pas-de-Calais was heavily defended. In the Normandy area, the best fortifications were concentrated at the port facilities at Cherbourg and Saint-Malo. Rommel was assigned to oversee the construction of further fortifications along the expected invasion front, and was given command of the newly reformed Army Group B that included the 7th Army, the 15th Army, and the forces guarding the Netherlands. Rommel believed that the Normandy coast to be a possible landing point for the invasion, so he ordered the construction of extensive defensive works along that shore. In addition to concrete gun emplacements at points along the coast, he ordered wooden stakes, metal tripods, mines, and large anti-tank obstacles to be placed on the beaches to delay the approach of landing craft and impede the movement of tanks. Expecting the Allies to land at high tide so the infantry would spend less time exposed on the beach, he ordered many of these obstacles to be placed at the high water mark. Now, the Allied air offensive over Germany had crippled the Luftwaffe and established air supremacy over Western Europe, so Rommel knew he couldn't expect effective air support. In fact, at that time, the Luftwaffe had only 815 aircraft over Normandy in comparison to the Allies, 9,543. And to deter airborne landings, Rommel arranged for booby-trapped stakes known as Rommel's asparagus to be installed in meadows and fields. Well, the end result, of course, while there were considerable casualties, the Allied invasion was successful. Of course, there was coordination with the French resistance. It was a campaign of sabotage to be implemented by the resistance. There were four plans for the resistance to execute on D-Day. And Plan Vert was a 15-day operation to sabotage the rail system. Plan Blue dealt with destroying electrical facilities. Plan Tortue was a delaying operation aimed at the enemy forces that could potentially reinforce Axis forces in Normandy. And Plan Violet dealt with cutting underground telephone and teleprinter cables. BBC's French service carried coded messages. And a lot of what we'll call caltrops were thrown on the roads. And it was a metal spike. No matter how it fell, at least one spike was pointed up, and it did a number on the tires of the German vehicles. Ineffective against armor, of course, but anything else. In fact, it was such a pain in the rear to the Germans that just having one in your possession was a result in a death sentence. 1965 report from the Counterinsurgency Information Analysis Center showed the French resistance sabotage efforts in the southeast resulted in 52 locomotives destroyed on June 6th, and the railway line cut in more than 500 places. As of June 7th, Normandy was isolated. And naval operations for the invasion, Corelli Barnett, an historian, described it as a never-surpassed masterpiece of planning. Overall command of naval operations was British Admiral Sir Bertram Ramsay, who served as flag officer at Dover during the Dunkirk evacuation 4 years before. He'd also been responsible for the naval planning of the invasion of North Africa in 1942 and one of the two fleets carrying troops for the invasion of Sicily the following year. Well, the invasion fleet came from 8 different navies, consisted of 6,939 vessels, which were broken down, 1,213 warships, 4,126 landing craft,
736 ancillary craft and 864 merchant vessels. The majority of the fleet came from the UK that provided 892 warships and 3,261 landing craft. There were 195,700 naval personnel involved. Of those, 112,824 from the Royal Navy, and 25,000 came from the Merchant Navy. Not quite 53,000 were American, and 4,998 came from the other Allied countries. Well, 5:10 in the morning, four German torpedo boats reached the Eastern Task Force and launched 15 torpedoes, sinking Norwegian destroyer Svevner off Sword Beach, but missing the British battleships Warspite and Ramillies. After attacking, the German vessels turned away and ran east into a smoke screen that had been laid by the RAF to shield the fleet from the long-range battery at Le Havre. Allied losses to mines included the American destroyer Corey off Utah and the submarine chaser USS PC 1261, a patrol craft. A lot of landing craft were destroyed. Well, it was literally the largest operation of its type in history. And it had so many moving parts, I don't know how it all came together. The the aftermath put 875,000 men on the beach by the end of June. On the first day, the Germans lost 1,000. On that first day, we lost 10,000, 4,414 confirmed dead. Now, the Allied victory in Normandy stemmed from several factors. German preparations along the Atlantic Wall only partially finished. In fact, shortly before D-Day, Rommel reported that construction was only 18% complete in some areas as resources were diverted elsewhere. And because of Operation Fortitude, the Germans were obliged to defend a huge stretch of coastline. Allies achieved and maintained air supremacy that meant the Germans weren't able to make observations of the preparations underway in Britain and unable to interfere via bomber attacks. Now, had the Luftwaffe not been seriously damaged, might have been a different story. While individually, the leaders of the Luftwaffe were superb pilots. They were more concerned with their place in the hierarchy than they were in commanding their units. And the bombing that was done by the Germans was generally off target and not concentrated enough to have any major impact. Well, there's a lot of ceremonies that have taken place. President Trump is there. You know, much of the alleged anti-Trump movement in Britain and in Europe is actually egged on by CNN reporting, which is available there while most other outlets don't have the coverage of CNN. Well, from there, one of the things I want to check, there was The special section from the USA Today network that covered a large section of the D-Day operations. And a lot of, there's still a good many veterans alive. They're in their 80s and 90s who were at D-Day or involved in D-Day in some fashion. That is, as so many have said, that is the greatest generation. They charge D-Day. At our universities, we have to have rooms where people can go if they feel offended. Things have really changed. Microaggression is the name of the game today instead of standing up and defending our rights. You know, there have been stories recently in the media that the Pentagon has admitted they're still investigating UFOs. Now, any mention of secret government interest in issues such as UFOs, alien visitation, invariably provokes imagery relative to such things as a Roswell UFO crash of 47 and tales of cosmic conspiracies coming out of Area 51. Well, it's a little known fact. U.S. government agencies have taken a great deal of interest in the UFO-themed mysteries of not just recent history, but of the distant past as well, particularly those with a connection to the issue of ancient extraterrestrials. Of keen interest to the government since at least the 1950s is a riddle that surrounds the means by which the pyramids of Egypt, as well as numerous other structures, were built. Even greater interest to officialdom is the theory that these same structures are built via levitation technology. It is a fact. When we examine the stories and legends of how the ancients managed to move and manipulate gigantic multi-ton stones, we find that levitation appears to play a significant role in the saga. In the 900s, for example, Baghdad-born writer named Abu al-Hasan Ali al-Masudi describes how stories had reached him suggesting the pyramids of Egypt were built in decidedly unconventional fashion. According to al-Masudi, the massive blocks would almost magically rise into the air when tapped by a mysterious metal pole. And considering or depending on how the stones were struck, that travel horizontally or vertically with virtually no manpower needed at all. Well, this ties in with stories coming out of the ancient Americas, as researcher Richard Mooney noted in his book, Colony Earth. He said, there's a tradition that appears in the mythology of the Americas that the priests made the stones light, so they're removed easily. And Mooney added this was directly connected to the legend of levitation, which he described as an actual technique or device long since forgotten. A similar story surrounds the construction of the city of Troy. According to the story, the god of music seated himself nearby and played such inspiring tunes that the stones moved into place of their own accord. We're also told that the Greek city of Thebes was built in near identical fashion. Amphion, a son of Zeus, reportedly plucked a lyre to effortlessly raise the huge stones of the city. Then there's the Mayan city of Uxmal. Now largely in ruins, it's said to have been built around 500 AD by a mysterious race of dwarves that had the ability to move gigantic stones by whistling at them. Rather intriguingly, Stonehenge has a similar story attached to it. It's the story of the giant's dance, which the mighty stone pillars are moved by music. Now, of course, we shouldn't take these stories literally in terms of lyres, whistles, and music, but they do all have one thing in common. They tell of the moving of massive stones by sound. And this is actually similar to something that today is very much in its infancy, but which the U.S. government has secretly investigated for decades. It's called acoustic levitation. Now, researchers Marie Jones and Larry Flaxman described acoustic levitation in their book, The Resonance Key, as two opposing sound frequencies with interfering sound waves, thus creating a resonance zone that allows the levitation to occur. Theoretically, to move a levitating object, simply change or alter the two sound waves and tweak accordingly. And although the U.S. military succeeded in moving small objects via acoustic levitation, the ability to raise multi-ton stones is still beyond their reach. Other avenues have been explored to try and resolve the matter, though. As the Freedom of Information Act has shown, in the 1950s and 60s, files were secretly opened on two authors who were aggressively following the notion of the ancients possessing levitation technology. They were an American named Maurice Jessop and a New Zealand pilot by the name of Bruce Cathy. Both men wrote extensively on what we might call the concept of anti-gravity in the ancients. Whether the product of highly advanced ancient extraterrestrials or a long-lost technology of millennia-old human civilizations, we don't really have any idea. But maybe some secret element of the U.S. government does know. Still on the matter of things relative to the Egyptian pyramids, we have to turn our attention to their nearest ancient neighbor, the Sphinx. It's a huge construction, 65 feet high and 240 feet long. General consensus on the part of the mainstream archaeology is the Sphinx was built about 2550 BC. But it's been suggested this particular date's not just wide of the mark, but very wide of the mark, making absolutely no bones about his belief that the Sphinx dates back much further into antiquity is Robert Soch, a PhD and an associate professor of natural science at the College of General Studies at Boston University. Soch takes the view that Sphinx may date back more than 7,000 years, and maybe even further. It's a point of view dictated by the fact that there's strong evidence the Sphinx at some point was significantly weathered by massive amounts of rainfall. And such heavy rain certainly didn't fall at any time around or after the conventional time frame in which the Sphinx was allegedly built. It's a good point that convention has got it wrong. There's another aspect to the mystery of the Sphinx, the interest that none other than the CIA has taken in that mighty structure. The late renowned psychic Edgar Cayce made the controversial claim he had been reincarnated from an Egyptian priest by the name of Ra Ta, who managed the construction of a magical and sacred locale that Cayce termed the Temple of Sacrifice. While in a hypnotic state, Cayce channeled the spirit of Ra Ta, who maintained it inside the right front paw of the Sphinx was a vast treasure existed. Ancient records on the truth of the legendary land of Atlantis. Now, for those not familiar with Edgar Cayce, he was known as the sleeping psychic. He would go to sleep, and while asleep, he would carry on conversations. He could diagnose illnesses. He could tell you how to cure those illnesses. He also channeled a number of ancient personalities, I guess is the best way to phrase it. Now, the Freedom of Information Act has demonstrated, although admittedly to a limited degree, that in the early 60s, the CIA quietly opened a file on Cayce's work. As part of its study of Cayce's claims pertaining to the Sphinx and the ancient mysteries it may well hide, in 1974, CIA remote viewers tried to use their mind powers to penetrate the Sphinx and psychically uncover what it was the Sphinx was so jealously guarding. What was discovered is classified to this day. Now, for those that are not familiar with remote viewing, there are certain people who are able to go into a light trance if you give them a six-digit grid coordinate on a military map, they can tell you what's at that location. There are rumors that that's how we discovered the location of bombs that Saddam's people had hidden in the burning oil wells in Kuwait. Freedom of Information Act has been a potent weapon in the search for truth. Also, in the matter of the CIA, there's strange saga of its involvement in none other than the search for Noah's Ark. The biblical story of the huge worldwide flood that allegedly wiped out practically all the human race is discussed in Genesis chapter 6, verses 12 through 20. We're told that after the water receded, Noah's Ark came to rest on what many believe today to have been Mount Ararat in Turkey. Well, it also happens the CIA holds an extensive file on the claims that Mount Ararat was the final resting place for Noah's Ark. Or as it's referred to within the CIA and by the Pentagon, the Ararat anomaly. It's a reference to a large object first spotted in 1949 by the crew of a U.S. Air Force spy plane. Now, whatever that strange object is, no one doubts that it exists. For some, it's nothing stranger than a weirdly shaped rocky outcrop that vaguely resembles a boat. For others, it's nothing less than Noah's Ark itself. And for more than a few, it's an ancient wrecked UFO that crashed and landed on Mount Ararat thousands of years ago, and it led to the development of the Ark legend. Because of the assertions, the UFO had numerous examples of terrestrial animals on board. Whatever the truth of the matter, there's no denying the CIA's interest in the Ararat anomaly dates back to the late 40s. Then in the 1950s, U-2 spy planes are flown over the area to secure high-quality photographs. In 1973, spy satellites were vectored over Turkey, once again as part of a concerted effort to try and figure out the true nature of the anomaly. The official story is that no firm conclusion has been reached, chiefly because of the inhospitable, icy, snowy environment on the top of the mountain, by the reluctance of the Turkish government to permit people to examine it in person. The off-the-record story, though, is at some point in 1975, a Delta Force-type team secretly parachuted into the area and made its way to the Ararat anomaly and found not a huge rock or even the remains of a rotting old wooden boat. The story is that what was discovered was nothing less than the rusted remains of a huge metal craft estimated to become embedded in both the ice and the mountain thousands of years ago. It was an ancient equivalent of the famous Roswell UFO crash of July 47. Well, maybe that's exactly what it was. And also, just perhaps, the CIA knows that the story of Noah's Ark was prompted not by acts of God, but by the actions of extraterrestrials who visited our world and died in the process. Certainly if, as so many stories have said, they came here to escape the destruction of their planet, perhaps it was an ark. There are some strange creatures on this planet. We'll leave it to the CIA to dabble in such things. Well, within the realm of ufology, the paranormal, the folklore, and the conspiracy theories, there's quite possibly no phenomenon guaranteed to provoke more controversy, debate, and unbridled paranoia than the story of the reptilians. Diabolical and ominous shape-shifting entities from faraway star systems and twilight dimensions beyond our own. Reptilians are cold-hearted, ruthless entities who have played formative roles in the development, manipulation of human history, folklore, and mythology, and culture. They're secret rulers of the planet, exerting powerful Machiavellian influence over each and every one of us. Described as 7 to 12 feet tall, green-skinned, scaled, and monstrous, the reptilians are the real masters of the world. Using their shape-shifting skills, they've infiltrated, enslaved government, industry, society, royalty, and even the world of Hollywood. In fact, it's said that just about no one's free of the terrifying presence and wrath of the dreaded reptilians. They're creatures whose existence and presence on our world has nurtured legends of dragons, aliens, and demons. Even the biblical story of the talking snake that tempted Adam and Eve to eat from the tree of knowledge in the Garden of Eden can be traced back to the reptilian presence and control. There's the masterminds behind alien abductions. They greedily feast upon the thousands of people who every year vanish without trace. For those that are not familiar with the statistics, every year in this country alone, 1 to 300,000 people vanish. Just gone. 7 or 8 out of 10 are people who vanish for a reason. Poor man's divorce, dodging bill collectors. But 2 or 3 out of 10 vanish completely with absolutely no reason at all. They surround us at all times, disguised and camouflaged, using and abusing us as the mood and the need takes them. According to David Icke, they can even count Queen Elizabeth II and Prince Charles among their vile, flesh-eating, and blood-drinking numbers. And their mightiest of all figures secretly inhabit vast underground caverns that exist far below the surface of our world. These stories are given to us from the conspiracy-minded. Now, when I started my show 30 years ago in California, I was contacted by a number of folks who talked to me about the reptilians. One man, and I thought he was crazy until I checked it out, told me his wife had been kidnapped by a reptilian. And I found out from a friend of mine at the police department, his wife had vanished. He was not suspected of having been involved, but it was one of the most mysterious disappearances they had seen. Perhaps the most famous of all the reptilians was Quetzalcoatl, a god of Mesoamerican lore. Mesoamerica, meaning central to the cultures and people of Mexico, Belize, Nicaragua, Costa Rica, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. According to a predominantly Aztec legend, Quetzalcoatl was a highly advanced entity with near magical skills, possessed of highly advanced science, who tried to bring civilization, technology, and a new world to Mesoamerica. His name translated as Feathered Serpent. Hence the potential connection to the controversy surrounding the so-called reptilians of UFO lore. Nicoleta Mestre said of Quetzalcoatl that he's represented in many different ways according to different epochs of Mesoamerican cultures. He's both represented in his non-human form as a feathered serpent with plumage along its body and around the head, as well as in his human form, especially among the Aztecs and in colonial codices. In his human aspect, he's often depicted in dark color with a red beak, symbol of Iquetzal, the wind god, and with a cut shell as a pendant, symbol of Venus. In many images, he's depicted wearing a plumed headdress and holding a plumed shield. As far as can currently be determined, the worship of this enigmatic deity began at some point between 100 BC and 100 AD. Should be noted, though, that devotion to serpent-like gods in Mesoamerica in general began much earlier. Evidence of such worship can be found at Tabasco, Mexico, which is estimated to have dated back to at least 900 BC, when it was embraced by the Olmecs. As evidence of the influence that serpent gods had over Mesoamericans, one has to only take a look at the Temple of the Feathered Serpent, which is sitting at Teotihuacan, around 30 miles outside of Mexico City, and which was constructed about 100 B.C. Classic imagery of feathery serpents, or war serpents, adorns the huge step pyramid, as it's known, which is also termed the Temple of Quetzalcoatl, even though it predates widespread worship of Quetzalcoatl. Such was a reference with which the people viewed their serpent god. Human sacrifice to them was both widespread and commonplace. Interpretations on what or who Quetzalcoatl was are as many as there are varied. In Mormon lore, we are told the story of the life of the Mexican divinity Quetzalcoatl closely resembles that of the Savior. So closely indeed, we can come to no other conclusion other than Quetzalcoatl and Christ are the same being. But the history of the former has been handed down to us through an impure Lamanish source, which is sadly disfigured and perverted the original incidents and teachings of the Savior's life and ministry. You know, it's interesting. There are a number of related stories. Back in the days of the Spanish conquest, when some of the expeditions moved north, they discovered a lot of the Native Americans they came in contact with were familiar with the stories from the Bible. And they talked about the Blue Nun. Now, the investigation by representatives of the church who were with the Spanish determined that this Blue Nun was actually a nun from a church in Spain. Apparently, when she would have what they termed her spells, she was actually co-locating to the New World. We're going to do a show about that in the not too distant future. But it's interesting to note that the stories that some of the Native American tribes told came straight out of Catholic teachings, which baffled the Spanish, of course. Carl Andreas Taub is an archaeologist who's studied the stories of Quetzalcoatl and states in his opinion the god symbolized fertility. He also said it's possible the alternating serpent heads, Quetzalcoatl and the war serpent, refer to dual aspects of rulership, the feathered serpent with fertility in the interior affairs of the state, and the war serpent with military conquest of empire. David Carrasco, a historian, has suggested Quetzalcoatl is a deity that represents culture and civilization. And now we come to the most controversial theory of all. Quetzalcoatl was an ancient astronaut who's determined to bring culture and science to what he perceived as a decidedly primitive body of people. And it's intriguing to note that throughout Mesoamerica, Quetzalcoatl was associated with the planet Venus. Alberto Mendo's paper, Quetzalcoatl Beyond the Feathered Serpent, notes that the date of birth of Quetzalcoatl, the day when Venus appears in the same position in the eastern horizon once every 8 years, is the same. Author Vicki Anderson said to the ancient Mayan, the Aztecs, the god Xolotl was the evening star and his brother Quetzalcoatl was the morning star. The Mayan, the Aztec prophecy that one day the god Quetzalcoatl returned to Earth from Venus. Now, according to legend, Quetzalcoatl and some people who followed him, assistant teachers, I guess you could say, left the coast of Mesoamerica, supposedly to return to his home in the east. An island, as he described it,
And he said he would return, and he gave a date. And on that very date, the Spanish landed. And that's one reason they were able to literally destroy one of the most powerful kingdoms in Central America. They thought the Spanish and their horses were gods. John Major Jenkins offers the opinion that the Toltec pantheon that represented the Xena's cosmology was Quetzalcoatl. His earliest astronomical associations with the Pleiades. Now, the Pleiades were known as the serpent's rattle, and the flight of the Pleiades into alignment with the Xena's sun evoked the image of a flying serpent. Now, that Quetzalcoatl was inextricably tied to the heavens above makes it relatively easy to understand why suggestions have been made that he was an extraterrestrial entity. Quetzalcoatl researcher Rick Popko has a scenario for the nature of the legend that is definitively extraterrestrial theme, but in a certain, slightly different way. He says his theory is that Quetzalcoatl was actually a very large UFO. As the craft entered Earth's atmosphere, it broke into flames and began its long descent, flaming, smoking, and spiraling out of control. If this thing was multiple football fields in size from the ground, it could very well look like a flaming serpent head, and the spiral smoke trails could be interpreted as feathers. Of course, a ship of this size is going to make a big impact when it crashes and probably take out a lot of innocent people in the process. Keep in mind, most of these people probably never seen anything like this in their lives, let alone watch it crash into their society and kill a bunch of people. The website Arcturi noted in its Reptilians and Aztec article that ancient aliens have been suspected to have helped create many wonders we see today, including the massive temples found throughout Central America and the Yucatan Peninsula. Like other great American civilizations, reptilians have been an integral part of the Aztec civilization, which cultivated a belief system around the aliens we now know as the reptilians. And then Paul Dale Roberts, in his In Search of Quetzalcoatl, wrote that it's also interesting is that there's a reptilian influence. It's saturated throughout Egypt, East Asia, India, and the list goes on and on. He believes a reptilian influence represents ancient astronauts that resembled reptiles. And this influence can be found in our own Bible, as it was the serpent that influenced Eve to bite from the forbidden fruit. So could it be that ancient astronauts long ago were living among our advanced cultures like the Phoenicians, Egyptians, and bringing their knowledge of science, math, and astronomy to cultures like the Olmecs, Toltecs, and the Mayas? Roberts provides us with a notable statement to ponder on. As the pieces of the puzzle come together, it appears that Eric von Daniken may have been right all along. And we've got a few more minutes left in tonight's show. And I want to address a question I got the other day. I was asked about the plagues of Egypt. Now, the Old Testament's filled to the brim with tales demonstrating that God's almighty homicidal wrath is not something any sane person would want to incur. Without doubt, one of the prime examples of how God could turn his hand to widespread slaughter, even of babies no less, can be found in the book of Exodus. It's a book that tells the story of how God threatens Pharaoh by warning him unless he frees the Israelites from the shackles of slavery, God will unleash a series of deadly, devastating plagues upon Pharaoh and his people. Now, Pharaoh, who in his mind was a god himself, ignored God's warning, something that Pharaoh ultimately came to regret. When essentially Pharaoh said to God, "Do your worst," that's exactly what God did. 10 plagues devastated the land of Egypt. The first turned the water, the river Nile, into blood. According to Exodus chapter 7, verse 20, and Moses and Aaron did so, as the Lord commanded. He lifted up the rod and smote the waters that were in the river, and the sight of Pharaoh and the sight of his servants and all the water that were in the river turned to blood. And that was followed by a plague of frogs. Now, the frogs were followed by lice, which in turn gave way to another plague of flies. Sounds like Texas in the summer. When all that failed, God turned his attention to the animals. Behold, the hand of the Lord is upon the cattle, which is in the field, upon the horses, upon the asses, upon the camels. And they died. Next on the list was an outbreak of terrible disease among the human population. It caused the eruption of horrific boils on the skin of the infected. And each plague was worse than the one before. And then he had it rain a very grievous hail, such as has not been seen in Egypt since the foundation. Well, after that storm, there was an invasion of locusts. But the eeriest plague of all was darkness. It was darkness quite unlike any other, so dark it effectively left the people of Egypt in a state of blindness. It lasted for 3 days. And then came the most devastating plague of all. All the firstborn in the land of Egypt will die. From the firstborn of Pharaoh that sit up on his throne, to the firstborn of the maidservant that's behind the mill, and all the firstborn of beasts. Now, I don't know about you, but that will tend to show that there's a lot more at work than we probably come to suspect. Now, prior to the mass execution of Egypt's children, God warned Moses that he and his people needed to take a specific step to ensure they didn't fall victim to the plague. And the only way to survive it was to smear the blood of a lamb on the door of the family home, which Moses instructed his servants to do. It was an act that ensured the survival of their firstborn. Now, Pharaoh's people didn't do it, and as a result, an untold number of firstborn Egyptians died overnight. Now, although Christians are happy to accept the story in literal terms, there's a distinct possibility the 10 plagues of Israel were provoked not by an angry, homicidal God, but by the work of a technologically advanced extraterrestrial. Using a combination of weather control technology and unleashing of deadly alien viruses on the human and animal population. Well, we've come to the end of another show. Tomorrow night we'll be talking more about this. So until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.